Hey, citizens of the interweb, you have landed on A Shot and a Beer, a weekly interview podcast featuring chefs, brewers, troublemakers, and heartbreakers. Every week, we're talking food and booze with people who do it for a living. So grab a beer, pour yourself a shot, and come along for the ride.
Test, test, test. All right, there we go. Now we're ready. Whenever you're ready.
Actually, we ought to leave that in and make that the opening of the show. Whenever you're ready. Okay, we are back. Shot and a beer. This is going to be a terrific hour. We have a power hour today. We have two guests back in the studio, both of whom are really at the very tops of their respective fields. But before we do that, I'd like to say hello to engineer extraordinaire Matty Bird. How are you, sir?
Oh, Captain, my Captain. Nice to see you, sir.
How you performed lately, the last couple days?
Oh, so we're just picking up the conversation that we had before we started recording.
Before we started. How did that go?
You know how they went.
Yes, I do know. It'll be cathartic for you to say on air.
You know, I'm a year into stand-up, you know, and they were two rough bar shows, and... You know, I failed to connect with them.
Yeah, but you know what? That happens.
It does.
And it's a year in. They're not all. It's not all going to be roses.
Absolutely. You know. So, but I did my time, and you know, got some chuckles, and you know, hopefully the next ones will be better. And I have some war shows coming up this week. In fact, I'll be at the
Madhouse this weekend.
And Throwdown. I'll be on Throwdown this Thursday.
Wow. Look
yes.
at you.
I know.
Full
moving up in the world.
Calendar.
It's rough.
Our guests today are our first guest is he's the lead guitar player of the Riftide Band. And I'm also told he does something in beer. Actually, I'm just kidding. Our first guest is the head brewer at Carl Strauss, Paul Segura. How are you, Paul?
Aloha. I'm great, man.
And our other guest is the sushi king and madman from Oceanside, David Waite from Wrench and Roden. How are you, sir?
Great. How are you doing?
I'm good. You guys, this is really cool for me because having you both on really represents everything that this show is really kind of about, because we're trying to do a show here that's about really interesting food and really interesting beer, and really just interesting food and beverage concepts, and both of you guys definitely fit that. Before we get started and we get into any kind of conversation, why don't we do kind of a quick bio? What got you to where you are now? Where'd you get your start? David, why don't you go ahead and start?
It's a fun one. Been cooking since I could reach the stove. Always loved it. Right out of high school, I dropped a application off to be a server at a sushi bar, and they basically said, "Why the hell do you want to serve? You go home, trim your fingernails, shave, take a shower, come back and make California rolls." And that's where it went with the sushi. I was lucky enough to work.
So you started in sushi,
yeah,
from Jump Street.
Yeah.
Wow, I didn't know that about you. I thought that was something that you kind of came to more organically.
It was pretty jumped right in. Actually started more making rice and peeling cucumbers and stuff,
right?
And then you know, that first night, so I honestly think a chef had just quit. I never asked him before I moved on, but they just needed somebody to jump right in there.
Right.
And then went back. You know, when I came down to Japango, I did start in the back and work my way up front. But yeah, sushi was first.
And it's been sushi ever since.
Yeah. I've worked at, you know, a French restaurant at night, a sushi bar in the day, bounced around so I could learn more, but sushi's always been there.
And I would assume that you didn't do the traditional Japanese method of you will make rice for the next 4 years, don't bother bringing a knife.
To some extent, definitely on an accelerated timeline.
Right. And you said you worked at Japango.
was at Japango, yeah.
And then after Japango, did you open the ranch right after that?
After Japango was, it was 2004,
mm-hmm.
opened the fish joint in Oceanside.
Okay.
Then after a while, moved on from there and kind of did catering for a little bit. But
mm-hmm.
my heart was in the restaurant game. I love it. I need to be there. So we got the ranch open.
When we met, you were doing, was when you were doing the catering, because you and I met at the Spirits Festival.
That's right. Yeah, that was.
And you guys were doing catering. Did you have a truck at the time?
Yeah, yeah. My brother had the sushi bus,
mm-hmm.
which is more the food truck.
Right.
And then I kind of stuck with the more hotels and more private
and
events.
Go to like events at hotels and hand roll at hotels and.
Yeah. And I think I was that the Spirits Festival. Oh no, we were that. That was fun. That was primarily the sushi bus and the catering.
Mm-hmm.
And then the beer festival after that. I think I was rolling with Anthony for Psycho Sushi, just hanging out with friends.
Yep.
A little after.
Yeah. Yeah, that was really cool. It was an eye-opening experience for me because, quite frankly, I'd never really seen two white guys rolling sushi. And that may sound a little,
racist?
No, not racist. I doubt it sounds racist, but it was interesting to me because it was, you just don't often see Anglos trained to do that.
Yeah,
I'm sure there's a bunch of them that do. Before, don't send letters to the show. If you do, send them to Matt. But
I like mail.
But yeah, I thought it was really cool.
Thank you.
And then how long has it been since you opened Wrench?
Almost 3 years.
3 years. Congratulations on the success.
Thank you.
You guys met great success straight out the door with that. And you started a new joint because, you don't have enough to do opening your own place. Wet Noodle 4 months ago, you and I were talking about?
Yeah.
And how's that?
It's even more fun, twice the fun, really. Get to do more cooked specials over mm-hmm. here. And that's the thing is like sushi was always there, but I mean at heart I'm a line cook.
Right.
I'm always in my head. I'm just a line cook.
Right.
And as we kind of work our way up in life, we don't get to cook as much as we'd like to. I still make sure I'm cooking a whole lot because that's why I do it. But
yeah.
It gives me a chance to be more of a line cook. And that's kind of a happy place for me.
I discovered that really early on. I was barely an executive chef, and I got a job at Opryland in Nashville, and I was the executive sous chef for restaurants there. Six different restaurants, 123 people working for me, and my biggest problem with that is I hardly ever cook, and I like cooking. I'm the same way with you. I got into this because I really like doing it, and you can't lose touch.
Yeah.
You absolutely can't lose touch.
I couldn't. Same for you. Couldn't imagine life without it.
No. So the Wet Noodle is, you and I were talking off air, the Wet Noodle is not a traditional ramen place, just like the Wrench is not a traditional sushi place. You guys get a lot of shit about that?
We get shit from the wrong people, and we seem to get love from the right people.
Mm-hmm.
It's not forever, and that's the hardest thing, when doing what we do. I mean, there's so much of our heart that really goes into it, and it's something that, your average amateur food critic would never know what a chef's thinking.
Right.
I mean, I know you do the same. You put a lot of heart into your food.
Yeah.
And, it's definitely something that it has taken years when people don't like it,
mm-hmm.
but everything is so subjective in food, and all types of art, two people can look at the same painting and have completely different emotions evoked. I mean, it's the same reason that the police never rely on eyewitness testimony,
Yeah.
You can't, it's even in we run both our restaurants. It's kind of like a team between my brother, me, and, you know, our other chefs, Alex is a huge part of it, and mm-hmm. it's more of a council than a dictatorship.
Right.
Even in that trusted inner circle that makes the decisions about what goes out at the restaurant, everybody's got a different palate. So I can't expect all the public to, you know, if everybody liked my food, I guess life would be boring.
I think one of the most telling things about your place is that it's a favorite in the chef community, which is a really pretty good indication that you got something going on right. It's not like a hangout joint. Everybody goes up there to eat.
Yeah.
I think that more than the neophyte, I'm the amateur sushi expert. The opinion of the industry weighs a lot heavier for me than the Yelp reviews ever will.
Very much so. And I mean, you know, what keeps this job fun is to keep learning. And
sure.
having such friends around me all the time, I mean, there's always ideas bouncing back and forth. And
it seems like every day I see somebody checking in at your place. You don't ever get a night off from industry because they're always driving up there.
Yeah. I work Sunday nights, which is a traditional night off for the senior zookeeper, is mm-hmm. what I call my, you know. And I love working Sunday nights because that's the night that a lot of executive chef, yeah, and dude, I get to see all my friends.
Right.
And it's, it's fun. I definitely have it good when all those faces are coming up to
see
me.
That is way cool. And again, congratulations on the success. You guys took off like a rocket, and you really haven't looked back since.
It's been fun.
Yeah.
Been really fun. Thank you.
Did you start turning our attention to the tall, bald gentleman across the table from me? did you start brewing at Karl Strauss?
Nope. I was at two other breweries prior to Karl Strauss.
Can you name them?
I can. The first was Hops Bistro and Brewery. That gig started in 94 out in
Where
Phoenix.
Was that? Phoenix.
That was at the... Okay. The old money part of Phoenix, I can't even remember the name now. The big shopping center right in downtown Phoenix, Biltmore Resort.
Mm-hmm.
And worked there for nearly 2 years. And then they bought the old RJ's Riptide Brewery at the south end of Fifth Avenue here in San Diego. And they did a leverage buyout of that. And at the time, I had 2 years' experience with them, and they knew I was from San Diego and that I wanted to get back to San Diego.
You wanted to go home.
So I moved back to San Diego and started brewing there and brewed there for nearly 2 years. And then Hops was kind of the owner was never really into it. The place was kind of going down a little bit, and they lost some key management people. And it was bought by the Cone Restaurant Group, David and Leslie, and they turned it into Hang Ten Brewing Company.
Oh, no kidding.
Hops wanted me to stay on board and go out to Phoenix and brew at another one of their breweries. And I was asked by David Cone to remain on as brewmaster and make beer for him. And that's what I did. So I jumped ship from Hops and worked for the Cone Restaurant Group.
Now, Hops, is there stock and trade brew pubs?
Yeah.
Instead of a traditional brewery.
Right, yeah. They had six brew pubs at one time. They were sort of the West Coast chain, and there mm-hmm. was another Hops Florida chain, and they weren't related at all. But the Hops Florida chain ended up expanding to like 13 locations. The Hops West Coast chain gave them the rights to use hops east of the Mississippi River.
Right.
And they did, and they opened up a bunch of locations. But they tried to sue us over the name, and we had trademarked it first, and then we settled, and they gave us a bunch of, I don't know how many millions, and then they opened up a bunch west or east of the Mississippi. And so the whole hops chain, there was one in UTC that was there for a long, long time. And in fact, my old friend Chuck Silva mm-hmm. Brewed got his start there. But Hang Ten was in the gas lamp for a while, and that was before all the convention center expansion started and the ballpark construction started and
right.
all that. So it was kind of bad timing because they closed Harbor Drive, they closed Fifth Avenue, and David Cone bought the Prado right at that time, and so he closed the brewery. And he asked me to stay on as like beverage manager or something for his mm-hmm. restaurants, and And, you know, I wasn't really interested in that. He pretty much said, well, I don't think I can do anything for you then. I'd like to keep you on. But and I said, well, there is one thing you can do for me. You can call Chris Kramer at Carl Strauss and let him know I'm working, you know, I'm looking for a job now. And he, while I was sitting in his office, he picked up the phone. He called Chris Kramer. And Chris told David, you know, have Paul show up on Monday. So I was just really lucky.
You know, I have heard just nothing but good stuff about the Cohn family and the way that they conduct business. We had Kat Humphis on last episode, and she had nothing but good things to say about them, too. They seem to do things the right way.
And they're good people. You know, and I think so. I think what, you know, one of the reasons they're successful, in addition to just knowing a lot about the industry, is that they hire good people and they let them do their jobs.
Right.
And then there's always this, you know, they're just nice people. And so people often do extra little things that aren't really required of them for people that they know and like.
Right.
So if you like your boss, you do little extra things.
Sure.
Here and there. But they were great people to work for. I still love David and Leslie quite a bit.
Now, when you started at Carl, what were you doing? Were you the
So I've been at Carl now for 17 years. When I started, there were maybe 10 breweries in San Diego at the time. Now there's like 130. I started as one of the production brewers.
Mm-hmm.
Carl was still alive back then. Carl was my boss. And there was another guy, an old German brewmaster named Hans Bilger, who was kind of a head brewer. And then there were a bunch of guys like me, you know, Eric Jensen, who's now the brewmaster at Green Flash.
Right.
Was one of the production brewers. Him and I were roommates up in Davis, so it was great to be on the same team with him again, and we had a lot of fun. Pat Korn, who's also the sort of brewmaster at Cellar, you know, at Green Flash at the Cellar 3. And so we had a pretty good team of guys. And we were all just kind of production brewers. And then, you know, little by little, I guess through attrition, we just kind of worked our way up a little bit.
Right. You know, for me, I originally lived in San Diego for about a year and a half in 2001. And for me, Carl Strauss is really kind of was my first entree into craft brewing in San Diego. We wandered into a Carl Strauss one afternoon and they had on quote unquote good beer, which I really liked the way that Carl Strauss brewed it. And I don't know that necessarily that Carl Strauss gets enough credit for doing it when there weren't a lot of people doing it.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. You know, a lot of people say we were kind of that stepping stone beer. We were maybe that brewery that kind of got them turned on to craft beer.
Mm-hmm.
But over the time, you know, over time, it's for the more mature breweries, you can't just, you know, change gears on a dime and start making all sorts of crazy esoteric stuff. You still have a bunch of beers that at one point were really different from what everybody else was doing, but, you know, those beers became flagship beers and we still kind of make them and you can't suddenly start tweaking a lot of them. We've certainly introduced a lot of new beers.
Right.
Most recently Aurora Hoppy Alice, Mosaic, you know, we do a lot of different beers and these days we're doing a little bit more experimental stuff, edgier stuff because the market is ready for them.
Right.
But back in the day, I mean, you couldn't start out making double IPAs.
Well,
stuff.
Yeah, I think the first time I ever had my first quote unquote craft beer in San Diego was Yellowtail. And I thought it was absolutely terrible because I wasn't prepared for it. I wasn't ready for that level of hoppiness. I grew up drinking mass produced beer because that's what my dad drank.
Right. You're not alone.
And I think that Strauss's model, their beers were always a little more approachable than, you know, for as an entree beer. I think I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I really don't.
Well, we don't either, obviously, but we do get dinged for it in the hipster community a little bit.
But
Carl used to say beer is a social beverage. You should be able to drink several of them in a social setting and still have, you know, your wits about you, whatever mental faculties you had prior. And so, you know, our beers were always sort of those kind of beers, social beers, you know, beers you can drink several of, and beers that are not going to be offensive.
When you, does Carl Strauss follow the German purity laws?
We do with the German beers.
Do you follow it strictly?
Actually, with most of our beers, you know, the beers that, you know, the hoppy beers and everything.
Right.
Even double IPAs, you know, they prescribe to the, you know, the Rheinheitsgebot. But, but as you know, we also do a bunch of Belgian beers and, you know, oatmeal stouts, and we do fruit beers and herb beers, and we do all kinds of stuff. So we, you know, the Rheinheitsgebot, well, just celebrated its anniversary, by the way, but it was great for Germany back at that time, but, you know, it's, we don't need to limit ourselves to that. It's,
right.
You know, it's beer, and we're in San Diego, so we make whatever the hell we want to make.
Sure.
So not being familiar with craft beer, not shocked that the purity with the word German is in it, the German purity laws. And then second, what are the German purity laws?
Well, they basically say you can only use four ingredients, you know, to make beer, which is water, malt, yeast, and hops. And it's been amended many times over the years. But originally it was kind of written that way because they wanted to save wheat for bread making, and they didn't want brewers to, you know, take the wheat. And so they basically said barley, hops, water, and yeast. And that helped preserve wheat for, you know, for bread making. And the other thing was it was a taxation law. It was basically, the whole thing was founded on this taxation thing that, you know, that the stronger the beer, the more ingredients you used, you got taxed on it. And so really, it's not much of a purity law. It never was really intended to be a purity law. It was really meant to, you know, let the government get their share of taxes on the, and to save wheat for making bread. And so it's, you know, it's antiquated and stuff, but it served a purpose back when it was written.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, us young upstart American brewers don't, we don't need to, you know, live by that.
We're taxed just
limit
fine.
Ourselves. Oh, we're taxed just fine. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Do you guys do any, or do you guys do any lagers?
Yeah. Yeah.
You do?
Yeah. I've got one fermenting right now at the downtown brewery. I just went and checked on it.
Nice.
Yeah. We still do quite a bit of lagers.
That's always been one of my favorite styles.
Well, you know, it's, there's a lot of different styles under the lager umbrella.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, lagers can be just as dark and have just as much alcohol as an ale or vice versa. The only difference really between the two is the time and temperature of fermentation and then the flavors that result from that
right.
time and temperature.
Right.
But, I like lagers as well. But I meet very few beers that I don't like. So.
The cool thing about our community is that one of the neat things for me is that I have known each of you for several years now, but in our community, knowing somebody and actually sitting down and talking to them is generally two different things. I met Davin at the Spirits Festival, and we probably spoke for 10 minutes, and then we hung out at the Joaquin Epic dinner, but we were both working, and that was a complete zoo with, you know, 20 chefs up there. I met you as the lead guitar player for Riftide when you played at the Handlery Pool.
That's right. Yeah.
And it wasn't until afterwards that I found out what you actually did for a living. So this is actually
that
cool
was Gus
for me
that set that up.
To sit down and actually talk to you guys.
Well,
you guys both cool. kind of do things your own way. Do you think that, is that a product of kind of San Diego, kind of not being more traditional? Or is it just something that you guys feel that you're, let me rephrase that because that's a confusing fucking question. Do you guys feel freer because we're in San Diego to kind of do things your own way rather than on a more traditional note?
I've got some ideas on that. Do you want to take it, though? I'll follow up.
I'd say yeah. I definitely think that there's more you can get away with in San Diego, and definitely definitely in Oceanside, you know, mm-hmm. like, people are a lot more laid back. I mean, and you know, the beer side of things isn't really, you know, my expertise, but
right.
the stuff that comes out of San Diego, I mean, you can do it as far as beer goes. San Diego is definitely one of the best, not to knock any other cities, because there's great things coming from all over the place. Mm-hmm. But when you're the best, you can do whatever the hell you want.
Right.
And that's really cool. With food, I think we can get away with a lot more and do a lot more just because we have so much at our fingertips.
Well, on the food side, and Paul, don't think I'm ignoring you, but on the food side, I think that we tend to suffer a little bit because of the laid back. I think that San Diego is not, I think we have holes. If you look at the culinary thing as a whole, we have definite holes in our game.
Yeah.
It's so laid back and so super casual. I think in order to be classified as a first class food city, we have components missing. We definitely have a fine dining component that's missing, because San Diegans don't really necessarily want to get dressed up and go out to eat, and they don't want to have to put shoes on, kind of thing. There are, and don't get me wrong, there are some really fine dining places, but I think that's one of the holes in our game. Do you think that can be kind of a hindrance as well?
Definitely. And just what people will spend on a meal is a limiting factor. You know, we have to think about the end menu price.
Yeah.
And we don't, you know, I don't like to play with cheap product.
Yeah.
You know, you go to big cities. I mean, and it's not really anybody's fault. And I think the general San Diego public would spend more if they could, but everybody's already paying so much to live here mm-hmm. that there's a certain amount.
There's not a lot of disposable income.
No, I mean, and we still have a good time. You know, everybody here does, but I totally agree with you on that. I mean, when you go to New York or London, mm-hmm. or, you know, there's a, and then I think the part of it, you know, like being in Paris, food is the culture. Like, you think about going out to eat food before you think about like having the most expensive new iPhone.
Right.
You know, it's a, you know, you probably say the U.S. compared to other places.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I swear chefs in New York City don't have a problem with other chefs calling in sick when the surf is good. There's just too much to do here.
He's right.
What do you think?
I think you guys are dead on. I think you guys are hitting the nail on the head. I kind of, as a native San Diegan myself, I kind of feel what you said about not wanting to get dressed up is there's a lot to that, you know,
because right.
I personally like wearing shorts and flip-flops and T-shirts year-round. I do love good food, though, and I don't mind paying a little bit more for it.
Mm-hmm.
The beer thing, though, is kind of crazy. I've seen people pay, you know, $10 for a pint, or, you know, I mean, Sculpin, people pay, like, you know, up the nose. I think there's a general feeling that, you know, people are willing to pay a little bit more for perceived quality.
Right.
And I say perceived quality because the quality isn't always, you know, equal to what they're paying, but the perception of quality is there. Or maybe if something's a little bit more rare,
mm-hmm.
you know, like, you know, Pliny is a great beer.
Right.
Never
had it.
Really?
Never had.
Well, that's a beer that people
I've never had the elder, the younger, the next door neighbor, the brother-in-law, or any of the other derivations of Pliny that everybody gets in line for.
I have, and it's a great beer, but is it worth standing in line for and paying, you know, $8 for a 12-ounce pour for? I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we live in San Diego, and there's a lot of really good IPAs coming out of San Diego.
Right.
So I think in the case of Pliny, what people are kind of paying for is the scarcity of it.
Mm-hmm.
They know it's not going to be around, you know, long, that this, you know.
Is that on a really, really strict allocation? Is that why?
Yeah.
Is it, or
yeah.
they just don't make
it's
much
on a strict
of it?
Allocation.
Oh, okay.
And they don't make a lot of it. So
right.
what is made only goes to like certain distributors and certain accounts and stuff like that.
Right.
So, I mean, there's kind of this thing where the scarcity breeds demand or something
yeah.
that's going on there. So I don't know. It's not the same as food.
Well, you know, I think though it seems to me that the brewers in town are, it's anything goes anymore.
We've got carte blanche. We can make whatever.
It has gone from, even during my lifetime, it has gone from major mass-produced beer, and it all kind of tasted the same. Everybody, like me, you know, me being 50, I drank what my father drank. And then people started wanting to do, like, fruit in beer, and they got slagged for it. They got killed for it. They're like, what the hell are you doing to beer? Then it moved back to, went through the ice beer phase where everybody was brewing their own ice beer. And God, this really dates me. This really makes me sound old.
We're the same age, I think.
Yeah, but then after that, it went back to just regular beer. And now with the craft brewing, anything goes. There's fruit, there's milk, there's peanut butter, for God's sakes. Yeah. I think that there's a certain amount of freedom. But I worry that it's going to go too far, that we're going to lose just really drinkable and approachable beers.
I think that's a valid point. I think we're already starting to see a little bit of that, where we're being, you know, looked at as sort of snobs, as beer snobs. The craft beer scene is, and I worry that sort of snobbery or that perception of snobbery is going to, you know, somehow inhibit new beer drinkers from coming into, you know, craft beer and drinking craft beer, especially this whole thing, this us versus them fight that we've got going on with the big breweries right now. A lot of the general public, they just don't understand that, and they think we're just a bunch of haters that are hating on Budweiser and everything else. They don't see the bigger picture. They don't see some of the behind the scenes stuff where Budweiser's really playing they're really up to a lot of dirty tricks, and they're really kind of doing a lot of crap to try to keep us from getting beer distributed out to people.
Well, you know, one of the things that tickled me about the ads, like that, the ad that came out during the Super Bowl, I believe it was, where Budweiser is like,
"Yeah,
we're not small, we're not craft, we're just," and everybody lost their mind over that ad, and it's like, this is Budweiser. This is a multi-billion-dollar corporation that's trying to remind everybody that they're a multi-billion-dollar corporate. They are the big kid on the block, and they did an ad that basically proclaimed that.
Yeah.
And it's not like it's news. I mean, everybody knows it.
They were helping us actually draw the distinction between us and them.
Right.
They were coming. Basically saying, you know, we don't fawn over our beer. We, you know, don't cook with it and don't do all these things. And we're going, excellent, because we do.
Yeah.
And you're helping us draw that distinction. We actually do like our beer with flavor.
We're making crap for everybody.
Exactly. The only thing I thought was tasteless about that particular ad was that they went after Elysian with the ad. You know, they said, we don't make, you know, pumpkin, pecan, peach, ale.
Right.
We make this, you know, yellow suds and plenty of it. Well, they had just bought Elysian like the week before, and Elysian makes a pumpkin, pecan, peach beer.
And, oh, see, I didn't know that.
And so, you know, they basically bought this brewery up in Seattle, which was, it's a fine brewery, and I know the guys there, and they make great beer.
And then just took a piss
and then
all
just,
over them.
Yeah, and then just basically slammed them in this, you know, multi-million dollar ad. I'm like, that really sucked. That was tasteless. You know, I can't believe they, well, it is what it is. But,
yeah.
No, I think that they finally got, they've been taking it on the chin for 20 years. I've been brewing commercially for 22 years, so, you know, since I started, I've seen everybody slamming Bud. You know, it's basically piss. You know, it's like, you know, having sex in a canoe, because it's basically, well, I can't say it on the air, I don't think, but.
Why?
Okay, well, they say it's fucking close to water.
There,
so it's
you
like
go.
Having sex in a canoe. And so they've been taking it on the chin, and finally they started, you know, dealing it back out. I don't think a lot of craft breweries knew how to deal with that.
Right.
I kind of went, well, we finally got their attention, and they're helping us draw the distinction. So I just let it go, you know, whatever. It's their deal. I'm more pissed off, actually, about all the unfair stuff that they're doing.
trying to keep... As far as distribution and
right,
all that.
Right, exactly. Trying to keep us from giving people choices.
Right.
Essentially.
What are some of the techniques that they're employing, kind of the dirty pool that they...
You know, asking distributors to, you know, not carry craft beer, or if they do bring on a craft beer brand, they essentially, you know, just kind of bury it or not, you know, not actively go out and try to sell it. They're buying up craft breweries, and basically every time they buy up another craft brewery in some market, they'll use that as one more tool in their arsenal to push an independent off the grocery store shelves or something else. So there's only a finite amount of space on the grocery store shelves for beer.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And if Bud owns, you know, the more brands they own, the more space Bud is going to take up on that grocery store shelf. And it's going to come at the expense of some independent brewery somewhere.
And if Budweiser is placing something within their space that is a quote-unquote craft beer, grocery store doesn't care.
Right. Grocery store still
gets credit for having a craft beer, despite the fact that it's owned by Budweiser and has shoved somebody off the shelf.
Right. Well, you know, here in California, all the Vons buyers, all the Ralphs, you know, they're all large chain grocery stores, and they've got central, you know, offices up in Sacramento where all of their admin people are. So the buyer for Vons or the buyer from Ralph's is usually in one building and in the same office or on the same floor.
Yeah.
There's a Budweiser guy in right in close proximity. And every time they buy a brand, that's automatic placement for that brand that they just bought in Vons, in Ralph's, in Albertsons, in all of those grocery stores.
Well, while we're talking about economics, this is something that's really actually near and dear to probably both your hearts. How are you guys able to compete? It seems like every year, commodities just continue to rise. Whether it's we're shipping a lot of grain overseas, or you know everybody's using corn for this, that, and the other thing, and it's causing trickle down in the other industries. How do you guys maintain profitability in the ever-growing market? Now, going, Dave, and what you do, I know what you're using. I know where you're getting it. And the stuff you use ain't cheap. You yeah. use very, very good product, and very good product is expensive.
Yeah, it definitely adds up. I think for us, using every little piece really helps.
Right.
And doing creative things with odd parts. And thankfully, we've you know gotten attention for that.
Mm-hmm.
So people are happy to come up. It is cool that I think on average people are spending more money on what they eat.
Right.
You know, and then I think the other thing is, I mean, we do run our restaurants more like an art project than a business. That also helps. I mean, it's the minimum wage thing's going to be, that would be interesting to see how it pans out. Thankfully, most of our people are above minimum wage.
Right.
So,
right.
you know, it is. I mean, it definitely... You know, it's that ever now narrowing gap that, I mean, food's getting more and more expensive, cost of living's getting more and more expensive, and it's not proportionate to any,
right?
Any what your average San Diegan is making, not
now,
by any means.
I know for a fact that you like using local. I know you like using sustainable. I've known you long enough to know that. Again, neither of those are cheap.
No.
And I know you buy most of your fish from Tommy,
yeah,
who is a friend of the show and was one of our actually early episodes, one of our best episodes, mm-hmm. mostly because Tommy sat here and talked for an hour, and Matt and I sat here with our mouths hanging open going, Jesus Christ. But Tommy is something special. But Tommy is very good at what he does. And you said you like using all the parts. Well, for the layperson out there, tell us what that includes.
It can be everything from fish guts to fish ribs. And when you know, it's always better to buy a whole fish from Tommy.
Do you normally get whole fish?
As much as possible.
Oh wow! And yeah. You're breaking them all down.
Yeah.
Wow.
And that's kind of a lot of times. You know, when you know, been doing it long enough to know what different meat looks like. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it honestly took 10 of the 20 years I've been doing this to really know, like, oh, no, this isn't Scottish salmon. What the hell you said? Not that it's ever happened to me, but
right.
It does happen out there. I mean, seafood fraud is crazy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the whole fish, you know exactly what you're getting.
Yeah, you're looking at it.
You can see, you know, that's exactly why Fish and Game makes you leave that little patch of skin on there so that it can be identified, because the skin tells you everything. You know, buying the whole fish, you know, when you go through the fish, if, you know, there's, you can cook the hearts, they're delicious. The collar bones are delicious. You know, you just might take a little more love, and, you know, a chef in a large operation might not have the time to be able to do all of that stuff as much as they may want to, because at the end of the day, it, you know, it is a business.
Well, I was just about to say the fact that you have, number one, the ability, and number two, the skill level to get good yields on whole fish. I don't know a lot of guys that are getting whole fish. We used to do it when I worked at McCormick and Schmick. We would get whole fish, or it, you know, at least whole sides on the bone. And then break them down from there. But you have to have a certain skill level to do that. Otherwise, you might as well just get it cut, because you're wasting a lot.
Yeah, it's delicate stuff to work with, for sure. You can definitely taste the difference.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it's also, I mean, nature makes the best plastic wrap. Skin and bones takes encapsulating that fish is gonna keep it better, longer, fresher than anything that man can make to replicate what already comes on the fish.
Right.
And, you know, when, you know, relative age, I mean, you take a fish off the bone, if you've been playing around with fish for long enough, you can actually see the change happen, you know, maybe not like a speed action YouTube video or something, but, you know, at 1 hour, 2 hour, 4 hours, you see noticeable changes in that meat.
I've often made the joke that, like, if you do skate wings, you can basically see them just deteriorate.
Oh, right in front.
Yeah, they go start going bad 3 minutes after you buy them.
Our little joke is that they turn into Windex.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, that, you know, it kicks off natural ammonia, and, I mean, skate wings, you know, it's not...
I love them when they're fresh.
They're so good.
Boy, they're good when they're fresh.
Yeah, amazing.
Unfortunately, they don't stay that way for very long.
No. You know, the Japanese have sayings that, you know, and the languages are different. There's no real direct interpretation, but I think it's mackerel. Say the fish, it rots while it swims. It goes bad so fast. And it's so matter of fact. I love the culture and the pragmatic, you know,
right.
This is how it is. And it's true, you know?
Well, I remember... Way back when I worked for McCormick and Schmick, the model for them was you buy fish that by the second day you should be out. So we were getting fish in 3 and 4 times a week, because they always wanted that constant turnover.
Definitely.
And since you're doing it raw, hell, that's even more important for you. Are you buying fish daily?
Oh, yeah.
Every day?
Every day. And if you know, between driving down to Catalina offshore, grabbing it myself, sending chefs down to pick it up, everybody that delivers.
That's a huge time
commitment. Like specialty produce, it's not fish, but it's produce. Dude, I've had specialty produce deliver 3 times on a Sunday to our restaurant.
They're so terrific.
They are amazing. If we have that at our fingertips as chefs, we owe it to our customers to use that and deliver food that's that fresh and that amazing. And, you know, luckily on the other side of it, I'm super thankful to have, you know, a regular set of clientele that eat the stuff fast enough to where I can get it in. I tell customers, like, we don't keep this stuff fresh, you guys do, because you're eating it, you're moving it. And we're just really lucky. It's easier to run a busy restaurant than it is to run a slow restaurant any day of the week.
The old adage is volume cures all ills.
Yes.
Well, what about on the brewing side? Brewing.
Okay, you're cut off.
Yeah. Wow, one shot in. What about on the brewing side? Do you guys see prices climb every year?
Pretty much. But yeah, you kind of hit the nail on the head a minute ago when you said volume cures a lot of ills. Because we continuously grow, we're able to see economies of scale. But with us, you know, we buy a lot of barley and hops, and these are commodities that we have to contract for. So we essentially buy futures. So we're buying, you know, some of our raw materials 2-3 years out.
So does that guys keep you out of? I know for the last couple of years they've always said that the Midwest is in the midst of like one of the worst droughts, and we see it on the culinary side because it trickles down to if there's no feed, there are less calves being born. If there's less calves being born, the beef market continues to climb. Does buying futures keep you guys out of?
It's all sort of interrelated. It's all connected. You know.
Does that keep you out of really seeing spikes in barley and
when
your malt prices?
When people started, you know, cutting into barley farms or acreage to plant corn for biofuels
right.
and things like that, or for cattle feed, we started seeing the price of barley go up a little bit. You know, most of the barley that we use, though, is grown actually in Canada, the southern central high plains.
Mm-hmm.
So southern Canada, the northern part of the United States. And some of the maltsters, some of the malt houses are in, like, Wisconsin and places like that. But, yeah, we see, you know, anytime you see certain things like biofuel, corn for biofuel or ulterior, like soybeans,
mm-hmm.
ulterior crops come up that might potentially cut into barley crops, it's going to raise the price of barley a little bit. What we've got to do is try to convince all the other breweries that are popping up to contract their needs so the farmers know how much acreage to plant.
Oh, okay.
So we try to get, so a lot of breweries are just spot buying. They're spot buying hops, they're spot buying malt, and, you know, we're trying to get them to let the farmers, give the farmers a little help here, them know.
Spot buying's got to be a more expensive way of doing it.
Yeah.
I would think.
I think they're just, you know, they have trepidations about entering into contracts when they don't know what the hell they're going to do in 2-3 years down the road.
Well, I guess that's, I can see that. You guys are in the game long enough to know that barring something, some calamity, you're going to still be in business
exactly.
over the length of your contract.
Right. And most of them are too. They just need to kind of get over that fear.
Right. Right. Do you get, do you buy all your yeast from White Labs?
We buy a big chunk of our yeast from White Labs, but we spread it around a little bit. We also buy from BSI in Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
We also buy from, we buy dry yeast actually too from some of the pubs. Fermentis works great. Lalamond works great. So
mm-hmm.
we don't put all of our eggs in one basket with any of our raw materials,
right.
with barley, hops, or yeast.
What do you guys do with your spent grain?
There's a farmer up in Poway. Actually, they own a bunch of dairy cattle,
mm-hmm.
and they come a couple times a day, and they take it in pretty large trucks out in Poway, and they feed cattle with it.
You guys are doing so much that they're coming a couple times a day?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, they take 3 or 4 yards each trip. Just spent grain.
Where are you guys with regard to production in the hierarchy? I mean, obviously Stone's production
like 3 or 4 times larger than we are
right.
now. So they're the big guy in
and
San
then Green
Diego.
Flash.
Yeah, it's kind of tough to say where Green Flash is, but I think they're larger than us. Ballast Point's definitely larger than us. I'd say probably it goes Stone, then Ballast Point, then Green Flash, and then Carl Strauss.
Hmm.
So we're probably number 4 in San Diego, and in the country we were 40 or 41 a couple years ago, but then they kind of relaxed the criteria for what a craft brewer is.
They seem like they keep changing that law
yeah, they
every
do.
Year.
And so that allowed Line and Kugel and some of the other larger
Yuengling
and some of those breweries that allowed them in there, and that bumped us down to like 44, 45
mm-hmm.
or something like that.
I've heard that every time they change the law, it's like Yuengling is either in or out depending on how they do the law. They're either in at number 2 or they're out completely. That's
right. So I think, you know, what it was they were independently owned and that allowed them back in. But I think at one time they were kicked out because the guidelines said anybody that uses rice or corn as an adjunct in the brewing process can't be considered a craft brewery. And then a lot of brewers spoke up and said, wait a minute, man, I'm a craft brewery, but I use rice in a Japanese lager that I brew.
Mm-hmm.
What the hell? That means I'm not a craft brewer? So they kind of relaxed that. And then, yeah, you're right. It just kind of evolves and changes.
Do a lot of breweries use adjuncts?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, shoot, everybody uses oats and, you know, hell, anything's fair game now, especially with this, this whole gluten-free thing.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen guys making beer out of chestnuts and all sorts of crazy stuff.
No, no kidding.
Yeah, yeah.
Gluten-free. The bane of most
That's
of our...
That's going to take us off on another tangent.
Yeah, the bane
it?
Of most of our existence.
You know, I don't think people are I'm going to go off on a rant, and I'm sorry. But I think if we just go back to making bread the way bread was intended to be made, allowing it time to leaven, allowing it time to rise...
Mm-hmm.
There are proteolytic enzymes in the grain that will convert those you know proteins and get rid of them. And
yeah.
We'll be you know, and you if you're gluten sensitive, you're not gonna have a reaction to it. I think we just need to we just are impatient, you know, from the time it's dough to the time it's on a truck is like 2 hours. And then
yeah.
They're trying to take it down less than that even. Just let it rise, man. Just give it
yeah.
some time.
Yeah, I really do believe that all the gluten. They, granted, there are certain people that have celiac disease, but in the overall scheme of things, it's like 1% of the human population has
right.
celiac disease.
Right.
It's
I think
small.
All the other gluten quote unquote sensitivities is all because of all the chemicals and the preservatives and. There's a lot of fear factor in that because everybody, you know, gluten was the hot thing for a little while. Everybody jumped on the gluten wagon or jumped off the gluten wagon, as the case may be. And it's a fact that I think is it's kind of eased back a little bit, but I think it's a fact that's here to stay. Now, you, Dave, and you and I were talking off air, and you said you have a specialty at the Wet Noodle strictly for that.
Yeah, definitely. And a lot of things. It's, you know, and when you have allergies and you're on the line on a busy night, it is something you got to take a little extra time to deal with, you
sure.
know. And different chefs have different opinions, and sometimes it's a fairly new thing. So it's a change in the system. Any change during a time of busyness is going to be a bit of a change up, and it could be, you know, could take a little extra time out of the preparation, and
right.
it could frustrate a few chefs.
So,
I can see that. You
so
know?
Over at the noodle shop, what are the gluten-free noodles made out of? Are they made out of soy?
More eggs, soy, mm-hmm. you know, heavier egg to hold that together.
Right.
There's rice flour, you know, I mean, you can always go the rice noodle, like pad thai noodle route. We use just a real eggy soy noodle.
Mm-hmm.
And then a miso, gluten-free kind of a miso built on top of like a classic French veggie broth. And a lot of stuff at the ranch too. You know, if we can make stuff vegan and gluten-free
you,
by default.
You just became my hero with the miso on top of a French-style vegetable broth. That's spectacular to me.
That's the only way I know how to make a vegetable broth. But, yeah, that's you kind of switch back and forth, you know. Like,
right.
But, yeah, that's I mean, I think it's something that, I mean, professionally, it's something we can't look away from it anymore. You know, for whatever reason, these people are getting sick.
Mm-hmm.
And for the people who have the allergies, life's got to suck, you know. I mean,
yeah.
You know, got friends that are allergic to lobster, and I just couldn't imagine such an existence, you know? Like,
wow.
So as much as possible, we try to, when it doesn't interfere with the quality that everyone else is going to enjoy, we try to leave the doors open for
yeah.
as many dietary restrictions as possible.
Right.
It's a real topic these days, you know?
I'd love to taste that miso broth just because I think it's incredibly interesting.
Cool.
No, I do. I like hot and sour. I generally like miso soup, but having that added vegetable component to it, I think would just make it really luxurious.
Oh, cool. Thank you. I think you'll like it. Definitely got to come up.
Oh, it's on my list. It's been on my list ever since we went up there the first time because I thought your operation was just really cool.
Thank you.
Are you, you guys are kind of experiencing a renaissance up in Oceanside. It seems like every week something new is opening in Oceanside. It seems like that's the hot spot to open new restaurants now.
It's cool. I mean, we opened the Fish Joint in 2004, mm-hmm. and there wasn't a whole lot up there. You know, there were some, you know, legendary places that have been there forever, but not much else. And since then, especially in the last 5 years, like, it's been really exciting. Like, it's changed a lot. And I mean, for me, there's already a list of restaurants in San Diego and never enough time off. But, right. Just eating in Oceanside, there used to be a time to get good food. We'd have to drive down here.
Mm-hmm.
And I still love coming down here. I hang out down here all the time. But just knowing that you can have a good meal and not have to, because it's a lot of, the cool thing about Oceanside is a lot of those chefs, I mean, some of them are in their late 20s still.
Yeah.
I mean, these guys haven't even reached the pinnacle of their career. It's onwards and upwards. And to watch everybody in this young community of chefs grow and come up, it's really cool.
You have gone very quietly from the interesting new place in town to actually one of the now old guard anchor places for the explosion that's going on up there.
It's funny how, it's definitely cool to watch.
Because of all the hot new hip places, you're kind of like the older statesman now.
No, I never thought I'd, if that implies being grown up, then I don't know if I like the title.
No, I wouldn't wish that on anybody. But it's true. You guys were the interesting new place just 3 years ago. And like I said, it seems like every week something else is being opened up there. And I think it's great because it buoys the community.
Yeah.
You know, it would be great for you, like the Foie King Epic dinner. Most of those guys came up from San Diego.
Definitely.
You could do something like that now and have everybody from Oceanside, which is really kind of cool.
Totally cool.
You know, because you'll get more. That night when we did the dinner up there, a lot of people were like, where do you cook? Where do you cook? Where do you cook? It's a hike. It's a hike to come down here for dinner. It's a hike to drive up there for dinner. And it's great for you guys that you have that core group going on up there now that you can kind of all do that sort of thing up there.
It's amazing too, because just like all of us have been friends for a long time with the whole San Diego guard, like all the Oceanside guys are we're all friends. You know, it's a really tight supportive community, and we take care of each other, and I think that sharing of ideas mm-hmm. has caused it to move forward at a more rapid pace than if we weren't friends or if
right. Well, the one thing I have noticed about being out here is that the chef community and the brewing community, and a lot of times they merge because there's so many beer dinners and there's so many brewery events and all that everybody kind of knows everybody else, and it's an incredibly supportive community. There are certain, to use the high school term, there are certain cliques of guys that always do stuff together, but there's everybody knows everybody else and everybody is cool hanging out with everybody else. I haven't really seen a lot of, maybe I'm not at that level where the real sniping goes on, but it doesn't seem like there's a lot of guys that simply just don't get along.
I agree. I think there's a sort of this collaborative spirit in San Diego that happens. I think, you know, chefs are a lot like brewers in that they're often also musicians, and they realize that mm-hmm. the food that they're making are their creations.
Yep.
And, you know, just because somebody else is making a different type of music doesn't make it any better or worse. It's just a different type of music.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, you kind of dig listening to other types of music. and trying different somebody else's food and trying somebody else's beer. Plus, there's this other thing that's, you know, it's all local.
Yeah.
Right? So it's all, you know, it beats the heck out of, you know, these humongous chain restaurants and stuff. There's somebody that you, that might be your neighbor who's a chef down the street and you want to go support, you know, or somebody who's a brewer down the street or whatever. So it's all kind of coming back to fresh and local.
Right.
You know?
Well, you know, it's funny. I'm a huge craft beer fan in the fact that I'm a fan of the people who are doing it. I don't drink a lot of craft beer. I don't drink a lot of beer, period. But it's
hilarious. We still like you.
What's that?
I still like you.
But it's really funny to me that every time I'm actually in somebody's tasting room, there's somebody from another brewery in that tasting room. I have never been in Society or in Hess or in Ballast Point where I haven't run into somebody else from the industry. And it's the same way with a lot of the restaurants. Every time I go to Carnitas, I run into somebody. If I go up to Davin's place on a Sunday night, I'll probably run in. I probably won't even have time to eat because I'll end up talking to people all freaking night.
Exactly.
And I think that's, again, that's very telling that we are doing stuff that other members of our industry are fans of. And it's something that I really want to help continue to grow here. I'm working right now at a comedy club on top of a mall, but we're independent. We're not a chain either. We do whatever we want, and you know, we're doing beer dinners here. We're trying to do more in the community, and it's because I like our community, and I like to keep that vibe going.
Yeah,
as much as I possibly can.
For sure. On the brew scene, we do a lot of collaborations, man. Mm-hmm. We're always collaborating with somebody in town. We've got this collaboration going with Amplified Ale Works and PB right now. It's just an ongoing collaboration. And we're making beers together, part of an ongoing series that it's raising money to go to beautifulpb.com, which is just raising money, you know, building bike lanes in PB and helping clean up the beach and stuff like that, you know. So when we can join forces for our good causes, you know, like the chefs, you guys have been doing that for a long time. Brewers are now kind of doing that thing and, you know, helping to support the communities that support us. That's huge.
Yeah. I've always applauded, you know, a lot of the restaurants. And, you know, certain guys are known for it. Davin's known for it. Rich Sweeney's known for it. Hannes is known for it. These guys are always doing this benefit or that benefit given back to the community.
Yeah.
Breweries have that component. All the craft breweries I know have that component kind of built in. Anytime we've asked for, you know, charitable contributions, people have just opened their doors. And I think that's great to give back to the community. I really do.
Yeah, amen.
Okay, guys. Well, we are going to get to a new kind of feature on the show. We did this once and said we were going to continue it, and then the following show we promptly forgot because that's the way this fucking show works. We're going to do what we call 5 questions. And Paul, we will hit you first. You ready?
I'm ready.
All right. Favorite swear word?
Fuck.
That seems to be a popular one. All right. You're on death row. What's your final meal?
Oh, man. Tough one. Probably a fish taco.
You were so San Diego.
Well, you know, born and raised here. Well, I'm going back and forth between a fish taco or a, you know, a Cali burrito or something.
Yeah. Oh, that's San Diego in the blood right there.
Yeah, definitely.
Born and raised.
We asked Letty McKenzie that, and it was her last meal on death row would have taken 9-10 hours probably. She just meandered. Okay, number 3, your biggest industry inspiration?
The person? Let's see, probably Fritz Maytag, Anchor Brewing Company.
Wow. You know, I really think in the he's one of those guys that he is a brewer's brewer, been doing it for a long time and been doing it really, really well for a long time.
He was on the scene.
I don't know.
He was on the scene before a lot, before just about anybody in the craft beer side, and he probably could have gone super huge and made just way more money than he did.
Yeah.
But he kind of intentionally stayed small and stayed local. And, you know, I've always thought he's in it for the right reasons. Mm-hmm. He makes quality beer.
Yeah, that was the point I was going to make. I don't know, you said that name to somebody out in the Midwest, they probably wouldn't know who he was unless they're a big beer enthusiast. But he's one of the giants.
Oh, yeah, he's an icon. He's an icon in the industry, no doubt.
Yeah. Number four. What's the trend you would like to see go away?
Well, I'd like to see guys stop trying to one-up each other on the bitterness and hoppiness of beers, because I think that it's gotten gotten a little out of control. You know, I think the alcohol content, the bittering, you know, units and everything, I think we got to go back to making sociable beers, beers that people can drink in, like I said earlier, you know, in a social setting. Going back to more isn't always more.
Right.
And just, you know, let's go back to what got us here. And, you know, the only way we're 15% of the market right now. All of us combined, all the craft brewers combined are 15% of the market. The way we can gain more market share is to go back to kind of making those beers that that the novice can drink, you know, people,
or at least have one or two in your portfolio.
Right, right. Have at least one or two, exactly. You know, some guys are proud of the fact that they'll open up a brew pub and have six IPAs on tap or something. You know, hey, have at least, you know, one, stepping stone kind of beer in that lineup, you know?
Right.
Get people into craft beer.
Okay, number five. Who, any time in history, would you want to have a drink with?
Wow. Good question. Any time in history, huh? I'm thinking maybe somebody like Gandhi or Martin Luther King or John Lennon.
Really? You're going to pick Gandhi to have a drink with?
Well, you know, if he drinks. I don't know if he drinks. He probably doesn't.
I bet he might be that type of guy that doesn't drink much, but when he does, he's a riot to be with.
I don't know. It's maybe somebody who's got some cool stories. I don't know. Maybe Richard Branson or something like that. Somebody with a lot of good life experiences.
I would have thought you'd have gone musician.
Well, John Lennon, I mean, you know, I mentioned him. Or Paul McCartney, but I think John would be funner because I think he'd be less inhibited to say it.
Right.
Like
it depends if Yoko's there.
Well, you know, he didn't say Yoko. He said one person.
So. Yeah. Right, no. I'm just saying, you know, she tags along, it may not be fun.
I discount what she
You're
said.
You're going to have tea.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, David, favorite swear word?
Have to be fuck. It's just such the perfect word.
I think in our industry, that's pretty much. I have gone through nights where I sat down afterwards and gone, I think I've said fuck in every sentence I've said tonight.
Sometimes it's just the word for the job.
Yeah. What's your death row meal?
God, that's a hard one. I mean, it would probably go back to comfort food, though. You know, like if I was about rather and go big, and there's so much, I love so many different foods for so many different reasons, but the simple cheese and potato English pasty would be like.
Really? Wow, that's really surprising considering the. No, it's actually not surprising because you do the high end kind of fusion stuff on a daily basis. I don't imagine you do a lot of pasties during the week.
Yeah, that's I mean, maybe because I only get good ones when I go back to England, so you don't get to have it all the time.
Right.
Like, you know, if crab meat was an endless supply and you didn't have to dig it out of those shells, crab meat wouldn't be such a big deal.
Right.
But it's because you hardly, you know, it's like, I mean, so yeah, it would probably be the pasty.
All right. Your biggest industry inspiration?
God, right now, I wouldn't want to say any one name. And, you know, I think everybody that's in San Diego right now is super, super inspiring. You know, just getting out and working with the other chefs in town. I mean, I could list off names like Eric Repair, and I mean, there are people who are just amazingly badass and I love them, but it's just as easy to be inspired by the guys that I work shoulder to shoulder with on mm-hmm. a regular basis, because I see shit that's just as cool coming out of San Diego. And if you know where to look for it, it's there. I mean, where San Diego as a whole and Oceanside has gone in the last decade, mm-hmm. it's fucking amazing, you know? And I'm glad I'm here to be a part of it.
That is a very sincere and heartfelt cop-out. but you know, the guy you named, Eric Repair, is, you want to talk about a genius with fish. Whew, Jesus.
A living god.
Yeah, he really is. Trend you'd like to see go away?
God. Somewhere between the whole hipster thing and calling people hipster. Like, if you call people hipster and everything you don't like or afraid of, or, you know, I mean, what the fuck happened to the yuppies? No one cares about the yuppies anymore now that we have hipsters.
We got old.
I guess so. But, you know, the hipsters calling each other hipster like it's a bad thing, but still being hipster is definitely getting a bit, it's just a little bit too hipster.
And throughout history, who would you like to have a drink with?
Probably Joe Strummer. I mean, I could pick a lot. I mean, wow. Adam, maybe like Adam Sandler for shits and giggles, but if I got to raise the dead just for the sole purpose of having a drink, it would probably be somebody more on the profit level.
Right.
And it would be cool to have a drink with Joe for sure.
It's nice. So.
It's a good choice.
People like that, it's sad. It's sad that they pass, because you know that there is so much left for them to say. You know, you get certain, there are certain artists that when they pass, you're like, okay, well, his best days were behind him. But somebody like Joe Strummer still had an awful lot to say.
Definitely.
Okay, boys, where can we find you? Twitter, Instagram, that sort of thing. David?
Facebook. Wrench and Rodent, Facebook, Wrench and Rodent, and Wet Noodle, Instagram. Most nights you find me at the restaurant.
Well, too. I know that. You guys have Twitter?
I'm not sure about Twitter. I think we do. But
that's not something you manage.
I can barely type.
All right. I'll call your wife and find out. we'll add that in post. And Paulie?
Oh, carlstrauss.com. I think Facebook is the same, Carl Strauss. On Instagram, however, I think it's Carl Strauss Beer, because somebody already snagged Carl Strauss on Instagram. And Twitter, I believe it's Carl Strauss as well.
Okay. What about the band?
Rifttide Band on Facebook. Yeah, thanks for that plug.
Absolutely.
Yeah, we're just a local.
Again, that's how I met you.
A local cover band, and we just, you know, rock it out and play all kinds of crazy stuff.
Excellent. Do you guys have any special events coming up that you want to plug while we're here? Remember, this has got to be delayed a week, or at least until Sunday.
We have events every month at our brewery in Pacific Beach, mm-hmm. where our tasting room is, our main production brewery. There's a big outdoor beer garden, and we have local bands that show up. We normally pick bands that have won a medal at the San Diego Beer Awards, mm-hmm. and we introduce a bunch of crazy beers. It's part of the Ales and Amps series.
Right.
Arts and Amps series, I'm sorry. And it's just a fun hang, and the money usually goes to Surf Rider or, you know, another, you know, local company or charity doing a good thing in our community.
Well, that's cool. So. David?
It's hard to keep track of all of them. I have a few coming up, no nailed down dates so far.
Okay.
For the most part this summer, I'm just looking forward to being busy and being at the restaurant as much as possible.
J. Matthew Bird.
You can find me on Twitter at jmatthewbird.com, on Instagram at Matthew_Bird, spelled with a Y. I will be at performing, actually on the day that this is going to be released, June 5th, I'll be performing at JP's Pub with Adam Connie at Point and Yell Production. And
but the show is Thank You Very Little, right?
I thought it was Second Wind.
That's Randy Villarba's show.
Yes. And then this one is JP. I can't keep all the bar shows straight. I'll be somewhere, JP's Pub.
Okay.
And then Friday the 10th, I will be performing here at the Madhouse on the Showcase weekend.
Excellent.
Very much looking forward to.
Excellent. And I am, we have the Craft Brew and Comedy Series Fall Brewing on June 14th, which is here, which I'm really looking forward to. We have a great lineup of chefs. We have an unbelievable lineup of comedians that night.
Paul Ogata,
yeah. Trenton Davis, mm-hmm. Brian Simpson, local favorite. And I am here the weekend of the 24th, 25th, for the weekend. So we got some stuff coming up. Gentlemen, thank you. This has been a great hour. Very, very happy to have you guys here.
Thanks for having us.
And you guys are welcome to come back anytime. If you have something coming up or you have something that you want us to put out, please let us know. The 12 people who actually listen to this show will be really, really appreciative of that.
Thanks, Mom.
The Mighty Dozen are a loyal bunch. All right. Well, I guess that wraps it up for this week, and we are out of here.
Last night I dreamt of flying over hillsides in the snow, and I drove down through the clouds to the valley there below. When the fields turned into parking lots, my freedom turned to dread. The ground rose up to greet me, and I jumped about out of bed. You can fly, fly, fly off to anywhere you choose. You can try, 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 but eventually you'll lose. It seems there's always something trying to bring a good man down. I have no fear of falling, but I'm hated in the ground. I'm searching through my soul, trying to find some extra change. I thought that I knew everything till everything changed. Now I'm standing on an island that is singing into the sea, and all that I can do is just enjoy the scenery. Well, you can fly, fly, fly off to anywhere you choose. You can try, 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 but eventually you're doomed. Say I'm before he drowns. I have no fear of falling, but I'm hated in the ground. I have no fear of falling, but I'm hated in the ground. Inside this little box. Oh, but you just can't take a lion and throw him into a cage and expect him to be thankful for the shelter that you gave. You can fly, fly, fly on to anywhere you choose. You can try, 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 but eventually you'll lose. The more you try,
ground.
Listening to Shot in a Beer. For information about the podcast, just search for Shot in a Beer on Facebook or find us on Twitter at Shot in a Beer Pod. Shot in a Beer is also a member of a Modern Professions family of podcasts. For other podcasts you might enjoy and information about live shows and how you can get involved, visit amodernprofession.com or check the network out on Twitter at amodernpro. Thank you for your continued support of Shot in a Beer.